So the next speaker is Mark Riedel. Dr. Mark Riedel is a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Diego. He's a program director for clinical immunology and allergy there. He's going to speak to us. He's also the clinical director of the U.S. National Hereditary Angioedema Center, and he's going to come to speak to us about how they've organized themselves and to share his experience with that center there.
Well, thanks, Stephen. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here as part of this wonderful meeting. I'm already learning a lot, and hopefully I can share some insights with you about our experience in the U.S. I'll start out just by saying it's always both an honor and a challenge to follow Marco, because as you heard and as most of you know, he's sort of built the Ferrari of angioedema centers. And we've sort of, I think, assembled a nice Ford right now. Maybe being from California, we aspire to be a Tesla, but we're in our infancy of doing this, and I'll explain why that is. There's a story behind this, but at any rate, hopefully some of what I'll share will be helpful to you. And I feel a little bit guilty about showing this photo after seeing the photos of Saskatchewan earlier. We have a lot of challenges in San Diego, but weather is not one of them. So this is La Jolla Shores. Our office sits about a mile and a half from the beach, which I don't get to very much, but it's a nice spot. So I'll just start by setting the stage. Many of you know that the situation with HAE in the U.S. was a little bit unique, perhaps, at least for countries that have well-developed healthcare systems, because up until about 2009, we had really no specific therapy for HAE other than androgens. And so while I was training and for many years after that, the treatment of HAE was really diagnose it and then decide whether you want to put people on androgens or not. That was it. There was no other therapy available. So when people had attacks, you gave them pain medicine, you put them in the hospital, you intubated them to make sure they didn't die from the condition. But there was very little complexity to treatment because we simply had no medications. That all changed in 2009 when the first C1 inhibitor became available. And then in the ensuing years, as you know, the landscape has rapidly changed. And we now have 5 FDA-approved medications specifically for HAE. So I just put this up. You're not supposed to be able to read this, of course. But when I sat down a few years ago to write this paper, and you guys that treat rare conditions, you know this, it's complicated now. It really has become a very complex process to diagnose the patient, to make sure they understand the condition, and then to set up an effective treatment plan that's really going to work for them. And there's a whole slew of things that have to happen. So over the ensuing years, the last several years, we became aware that this was a real challenge for individuals that had angioedema, getting the right diagnosis, getting the right treatment, and then setting up this plan that really has to be reviewed and sometimes change over time. And so this is just some data that I've done a couple surveys in the U.S. over the years, and I know Stephen's doing some similar things here in Canada. But just to show you that the lay of the land in the U.S. is we're sort of geographically challenged like you are. People are spread out. And we have lots of doctors treating HAE. Most of them are allergists. There's a pointer here. Although this is probably a bit skewed because those are largely who we asked. We know there are other specialties doing this. This is a low number. This is the minimum number that are treating. But the point is that most of the patients in the United States are being treated by people who have little to no experience in HAE. So when you survey the docs taking care of these, most of them have, in the course of their career, seen less than 10 patients with this condition. And in fact, almost half of these patients, their doctor says, I only have that patient or their family. So very little experience managing this. And so what we saw when we asked about practice patterns in the last few years is that there was a huge inconsistency. It just depended on who you saw because nobody was doing the same thing. If they happened to be up to date on the new guidelines, great. If they didn't, they were still giving you androgens and saying good luck. So we had a huge unmet need that was recognized in the last several years in terms of getting people up to the treatment that's recommended in the current evidence-based guidelines. And we also had a huge issue that was identified in studies showing that most families weren't tested for this, even if there was a patient that had been identified. So only about half of families underwent testing, so a diagnosis problem also. About this time also, we, like you have in Canada, we put out an evidence-based recommendation guideline that was from the Medical Advisory Board for the U.S. HAE Association. And one of the main things that we recommended, and again, based just empirically on seeing in other countries how this has worked, was that we really should be having referral centers or a network of specialists. And we really didn't have that. So one of our major goals was to start this network and to have at least one recognized comprehensive center that could sort of help with this process of diagnosing and treating patients. So that led to the establishment of our center in San Diego at University of California, San Diego, and we developed a mission statement, which I won't read to you, but it really speaks to some of the things that we heard about this morning of developing comprehensive care. So not only having state-of-the-art diagnosis, but also being familiar with the state-of-the-art treatments, patient support programs, and also then research, which I'm going to say a few words about research towards the end. And so how did this come about for us? Again, we may have a bit of a unique situation, but I think it's helpful to share. This really came from the patients, and I think our existence is a real testament to what patient advocacy groups can do if they're organized, driven, and willing to dedicate resources to these sorts of things. So the patients, of course, in the U.S. are organized into the U.S. HAE Association. And over the years, this association had developed a medical advisory board of several physician specialists in the country that have a lot of clinical and research experience in hereditary angioedema. And so our existence in San Diego is really the culmination of those things coming together, along with a registry and biorepository effort that Marco spoke about, how his and how it's very advanced in Italy. Ours has also been going on for a while, so it was an effort to incorporate both the clinical activities as well as the registry activities on a U.S.-wide basis. And so this is, as you all know who work at centers, this is a collaborative effort from lots of different angles. Those of you who know Anthony Castaldo, who's the president of the U.S. HAEA, he is a dynamo, and this was always his vision to have a center that patients could go to for comprehensive evaluation and care. So you can't understate the contributions and the vision of Tony in driving a lot of this. Those of you that work at universities know this isn't an easy sell sometimes. I will tell you that we had many conversations with the University of California, and the administrators at the end of one meeting said, well, you can try this, but you will fail within 3 years. That's what they told us. So I'm happy to say that we've exceeded expectations of that low bar. We've now been open almost 4 years, so we thank you. And in fact, they've changed their tune. They're actually quite proud of what we're doing now, and we remind them of that occasionally. So you have to have good physicians, and it took some time to assemble the team. So we have three HAE specialists at the center. And then it was mentioned earlier, but sustainability is a huge issue. And it is for us, too, because we have no government support for this sort of endeavor. So, in fact, we have an operating endowment that comes from donations. It comes from the patient advocacy group. It comes from private donors. It comes from corporate donors. So this is actually a constant activity of ours, is to sort of make sure that we're sustainable and that our business plan can continue to keep the doors open for a very long time. We work closely. I'll show you the network in a moment. We work closely with our colleagues at other sites around the country to have not only concerted sort of clinical collaboration, but a research network that we're now building out and think is very promising. And then the physical space. We built the center at a new space just off the university campus, and developing the staff is incredibly important. So our model is really sort of this. We're very patient-centric. We think that's critical to our success. This is Bruce Zura's slide because this is sort of how he thinks about it, but I totally agree. You have to have the staff. I'll say a few words about that. You have to have familiarity and availability of the therapeutic options that are out there. You have to have adequate resources, and then, of course, we think the research endeavors of these centers is actually also a very important piece to use our expertise to advance the field. Our clinical operations, because that's where I spend a lot of my time, is making sure that this works in the way that we envisioned it. It is sort of designed to be what we call high touch. And any of you in the rare condition space know that it's not easy to be someone with these conditions. For lack of a better term, I tell our fellows and residents, listen, these people have been through the ringer with the healthcare system. They've been misdiagnosed, they've been undiagnosed, they've been treated with the wrong treatments. No one knows what they're talking about when they go to the hospital or the emergency department. So it's really incumbent on us to make them comfortable and make them feel like they belong to a community that knows how to deal with these conditions. So that's actually built into the office. We've tried to make the office feel less like a clinic and more like a, I don't want to say a lounge, but it's a user-friendly place. Our scheduling is set up so that we have lots of time. We have people traveling, and they're able to spend a half a day or a day with us if they want to meet with various people on the team. The geography, we're talking about wide open spaces. We have a lot of issues with people being able to travel to see us, and we do have some funding through a foundation to help with travel assistance, coordination of records, of course. And then this is huge. It takes a team, as we've been talking about, and we've worked very hard to build a hand-selected team. And then, as was mentioned earlier, to retain that team, because if you build the expertise, you don't want those people to leave. So retention has been a very important part of what we do. And then lastly, sort of all the nuts and bolts of setting up treatment plans. So we collaborate very closely with primary care physicians, local allergists from where the people live, to make sure that these plans that we think will work best for each individual actually happen at the local level. I will say this last line, this has been a big challenge for us, and I'm interested, if we have time later today, to pick some of your brains about how you do remote medicine or telemedicine. Because we would love to be doing this. This makes all the sense in the world, I think, for rare conditions. We have huge challenges in terms of getting reimbursed for this. We give a lot of free advice away because there's no way to be compensated for that time. And in the U.S., there's also a lot of medical legal issues across state lines. I don't know if that's an issue that you all deal with, but we have to be careful about what we do remotely because of, I don't have a license in New York State. There can be issues in terms of me caring for a patient there. So we're very aggressively exploring ways to do telemedicine, remote medicine, but we haven't cracked that nut yet in a way that sort of works for our healthcare system. So as you've heard from, I think, the hemophilia centers talked about earlier, we also have a team. We have clinical nurses. We have administrators to help with authorizations in the insurance system. We have study coordinators. We've had a lot of success with this nurse navigator position. This is a person who sort of course, reaches out to the patient and is kind of a single point of contact. And I think patients really like this. It's someone to sort of help them navigate the different steps of their care plan. She also makes sure I'm doing what I'm supposed to do also. So she's kind of the boss, I say, at the office. And then we do collaborate closely and, in fact, lean heavily on the U.S. HAE Association. They have wonderful patient support programs that include things like advocates. These are nurses, health advocates, but also other patients that are willing to help people with questions or problems sort of on a practical basis. So we refer a lot of people to the HAEA to sort of get additional help and information. And so it's really this patient-centric care. It's we spend a lot of time with patients. We have that luxury because of the funding that we have available, but we want people who are traveling a long way, they get it at least 90 minutes with a physician. Sometimes it takes longer than that. Beyond that, as was said earlier, you can't do this without nursing support, and so we have nurses that are very knowledgeable. that are able to teach people to self-infuse if that's what they're interested in doing with some of the treatments. And I'm a big proponent of shared decision-making so that we sort of go through all the options and walk through the risks and benefits of different treatment strategies such that the patient, I hope, feels invested in this. And my experience is that those plans are much more tolerable and people adhere to them better once they've sort of been involved in that process. The other thing that has become really apparent in the U.S., I think, is that there's a need for family education. That we know that these conditions don't just affect the person that has has HAE, but affect the entire family unit. So, again, we lean on the patient association, but we're also in the process of developing online educational modules that we can refer people to and that will sort of at their own pace let them learn about HAE and how to treat it and so forth. We also have implemented some family testing. This is a study from a couple years back now, but we actually had untested first-degree relatives, and the sort of shocking thing was that we found 30% of those people that had never been tested before had C1 inhibitor deficiency. So we know that there are undiagnosed patients out there, and some of these were kids, so you'd say, well, they may not be symptomatic because that often happens later in childhood. But in fact, almost two-thirds of these people, they had angioedema symptoms. They just either ignored it or nobody ever bothered to test them. And so these are people who were at grave risk for something really tragic happening to them without any diagnosis or treatment plan. So this is another big effort is to sort of make sure we're detecting this condition so that it can be treated appropriately. Marco touched on this already. We do find it very useful to give people treatment letters, treatment cards. This is just our example of a wallet card that can be folded up. And this has been not foolproof for sure, but helpful in terms of people presenting to the emergency department. As was said easier, though, I'll just emphasize, our goal is to keep people out of the hospital. And that's one of the real benefits that we're trying to measure now in a quantitative way. But we hear it over and over again that the people are no longer needing to go to the hospital, no longer needing to go to the emergency department, unless they're having airway issues. And so that's I think, a big plus with these sorts of educational programs that teach people to self-administer and be self-sufficient. So we're trying to get away from this. Healthcare has become very mechanized in some ways, and so we're trying to get away from the barcode approach that everybody gets the same therapy. That's not unique to HAE, but I think it's actually very, very important, maybe more important in HAE than some other chronic conditions because of the options that we have and the different strategies we can use and the tremendous variability that we know occurs with these patients in terms of their phenotypic symptoms. So just to show you, this is not proof that we're doing a good job, but it's encouraging that the sort of if you build it, they will come model. We've now, since we opened our doors in early 2014, we've seen over 700 patients for evaluation of angioedema. And I will point out that only a fraction of those turn out to have C1 inhibitor deficiency, right? So we see lots of other types of swelling. We're not exclusive to HAE. But we've served a pretty large, I think we are the biggest center in the U.S. in terms of volume, and we're seeing steady growth. We're on course to see almost 400 patients this past year. Most patients from the U.S., we've seen most out of most states in the union, but we have seen some patients from north of our borders, south of our borders, as well as some patients from Africa and Asia. So we're welcoming, of course, international patients if they want to make the trip to San Diego. So let me say a few words then about research, because I do think this is an important component of comprehensive care centers. It's probably not a requirement per se, but I think it makes sense that we try to push things forward in terms of taking better care of people. So, of course, we're involved in a number of the investigational studies for new treatments of HAE. There continue to be developments in that avenue. We also have a big translational research program, and this goes back to the biorepository that's been built, and we continue to expand. I'll say a few words in a moment about this HAE with normal C1 inhibitor. Again, Marco touched on this, but this is something we're very interested in for reasons I'll explain in a moment. We also have some, non-pharmacologic interventional studies, or at least trying to understand the association between stress-exacerbating HAE, and this big question about whether diet can influence it. I don't know about in Canada, but everybody in the U.S. is convinced they have a food allergy of some sort, and so that's probably the biggest question I get, is do foods make my HAE worse? And the honest answer is we have no idea. We don't think so, but no one's ever done a study looking at this closely. So we're actually trying to dip our toes into that pool to look at whether nutrition influences the course of this condition. And then, as I mentioned, just this past year, really, we've established formally this research network, which, again, has been done in Europe and other countries, but we really had never formally established this. And so we sort of maybe were the hub here, but we have lots of colleagues who are excellent specialists in HAE, have good research capabilities, and so we're trying to collaborate so that we can more efficiently accomplish some of these research goals. I noticed this morning when I was looking at this, we've somehow steered clear of the Canadian border. I don't know why that is, so I have to get some hypotheses about that. So, this is the registry that we have in the United States. It's now housed at UCSD. Again, we don't know for sure. We think there's probably 6,000 or 8,000 C1 inhibitor deficient patients in the U.S. We have no idea how many people may suffer from HAE with normal C1 inhibitor, although presumably it's a much rarer condition than C1 inhibitor deficiency. But we've set this up, as you might expect, that patients, either through the patient association or through their physician investigator, are able to enroll into the registry, and then it's an internet-based platform where ideally we get lab samples to establish the diagnosis, and we're going to be doing some genomic work on that. But collection of their clinical data, their attack rate, a lot of the things that Marco showed you already is collected through standardized forms on the web or through smartphone collection, and this makes it efficient to try to collect as much data as we can. As he said, the more data we have, the better chance we have to understand some of the patterns and phenomenons in HAE. So this was established actually about 12 years ago. We have nearly 1,000 people in the registry right now. We have a considerable number of samples in the biorepository, including DNA and serum. And then we have these medical history, general medical, and then attack event history that's ongoing, being collected in an ongoing fashion. So we've just moved this last year from what was really a private company to the CTRR, the Clinical Translational Research Institute at UCSD, and now are starting to dig into the biorepository to confirm the diagnoses of these patients. And we have some very exciting collaborations starting with the UCSD Institute for Genomic Medicine. And so, as we all know, this is where things are going. So we hope we'll be able to say something about this population through genomic studies. Just a couple words about HAE with normal C1 inhibitor, what we used to call type 3. As you heard from Marco, this is really a poorly understood condition. We have these mutations, the factor 12 mutation, the plasminogen, the angiopoietin 1, that account for a small group, at least in the United States, a very small group of these patients. And there was this expert panel a few years ago that sat down and tried to establish some clinical criteria to help sort out what to do with these patients that are swelling and seem to be resistant to histamine-targeted treatment, so so-called non-histaminergic angioedema. These criteria are not great, honestly. I think we've gone round and round about how we can make them better. But essentially, we need a biomarker for this condition. And the reason I bring this up, it's probably a very rare condition, but this has caused enormous problems in the angioedema space in the United States. And the reason is that we've, I guess, been a victim of our own success. When we've given lots of talks about hereditary angioedema, there are practitioners out there now giving lots of people this diagnosis of HAE with normal C1 inhibitor if it's difficult to control or they have a lot of symptoms. And what's happening is that this group of people, which remains very poorly defined, are consuming a lot of medicine, a lot of these very expensive medicines. And so it's increasingly putting pressure on the system, which unfortunately comes back to more restrictions being put on people that have C1 inhibitor deficiency, because the payers are starting to clamp down on the ability to prescribe these bradykinin and targeted medicines. So we have a huge incentive right now, at least in the U.S., to solve this problem. And we're not unique. There are labs around the world, including Marco's, that are working on this problem. But we do a lot of our translational work right now because we see a lot of these patients for second opinions is trying to identify a biomarker that will allow us to draw a circle around these people. As sort of, yes, you have this, or no, you don't have this, because we don't see any activation of the contact system. And only then, of course, can we really do studies that will tell us what's the best treatment for this group of people. Right now, it's very uncontrolled, empiric treatment, which honestly is not rational in some of the patients I see, and it consumes an enormous amount of resources. So at any rate, that's one of the unknowns we're working on, because it is causing major issues with regard to payers and the ability to get medications for people who really need those medicines, and they're proven to work, the C1 inhibitor deficiency patients. Now, just, I don't want to step on any toes. This is a real condition, and some of these people are very, very sick. So I don't want to marginalize or trivialize the issue, but we just need a better way to deal with it in the clinical setting. And so we have, as part of our setup at the center, we have complex ways to collect blood so that we can look at different mediators. And again, you can't understate the importance of staff that know how to do this and collect the blood in the fashion that we need to, with the appropriate phenotype and symptoms attached to it, so we can try to do the analysis once we have the biomarker data. So this is just, as I head towards the end, this is just sort of how I look at things for what we need to keep doing well in order to make progress. The registries are incredibly important. I mentioned a little bit about payers, and in our country, the payer system is extremely fragmented, as I'm sure you've heard in the news. So we have to deal with lots of different companies and lots of different interests in terms of who's going to pay for these medications and cover patients that have rare conditions. So we're, of course, very active and vocal in that fight to try to make sure the patients get the treatment that's effective. And then I've mentioned some of the research issues. I have down here at the bottom two of the challenging ones that we haven't done much work in, but I think are, as we've talked about, are going to be really important. So quality of life, how do we measure that? We need data on that to show that what we think is helping is actually making a difference for people that have these conditions. And then pharmacoeconomics, and for better or worse, I think we have to get out in front of this. Someone is going to, and I think we need to have our voice heard as well as the patient's voice heard when these sorts of analyses are being done. But that data needs to be looked at, I think, more closely. We do have educational programs, which are kind of the last piece I think are important for comprehensive centers. So we see lots of students and trainees coming through. We actually have a center-based CME program. I call it the Traveling Roadshow, but we go out around the country and talk to these societies of specialists that are taking care of these patients. Because, again, not everyone's going to get to us. They're going to see their local doctor, and we want to make sure that they've heard about the latest effective therapies and diagnostic techniques. We do a lot of peer-to-peer discussions, sort of curbsides by email and phone. And then we're very proud of this. We actually just this past year have opened up on a limited basis what we call visiting scholars. And these are people from outside the U.S. We've actually had some Canadian physicians come spend a couple of weeks with us and just see a lot of patients so that they get more comfortable evaluating angioedema. So we've had physicians from Africa, and we're going to have some physicians from Thailand in the next few months as well. So just to wrap up, this is how I think about things. We have the clinical care. I've covered some of the things that we're working on there. We're trying to improve. We have the research efforts I've covered, and then last but not least, the educational efforts, not only for our colleagues, our healthcare providers, but also for the patients and their families. And lastly, this is thin, so that's why I left it to the end. How have we measured our success? And we have very little objective data right now to know how well we're doing. So I think we've got to really figure out ways to measure this. We have done some patient surveys in the last few years. These are not exclusively patients seen at our center, but a lot of them have been to our center or have seen other people in our network of specialists. And we have seen progress. This is over a 3-year period from the introduction of some of these new treatments till about 2 years ago. So this is looking at different domains of burden of illness, including the psychological impact in blue, the daily symptoms people have in purple, fear of dying from their condition in the magenta there, and side effects from medicines. And you can see that the lower scores are better. So you can see the severity of these impacting people's lives has decreased. It's actually most impressive for the people that have really severe HAE, though, of course. So there's room for improvement, particularly in this group that may not have very frequent or dramatic symptoms. So we have some indication. We don't know that that's our efforts per se, but we have some indication that we're improving people's lives. We have seen, when we look at surveys, we've seen reductions in the things, the use of opioids, for instance. We've seen reductions in the people that are getting no treatment for their attacks. We've seen reductions in hospital visits, and not statistically significant, but ER visits, and an increase in self-administration. And this data is about 3 to 4 years old now, so we're in the process of, again, revisiting this. We hope to see more dramatic changes, keeping people out of the hospital and having them treated at home, as that's the most efficient and effective way to do this for most people. And then lastly, these are just anecdotes, but that's unfortunately what we've got at the moment. We do continue to improve the diagnosis for people, both people that have been missed, that do have HAE, but we have undiagnosed people too, that have been told this and it's wrong. They don't have C1 inhibitor deficiency, so that's important. Getting people access to medicine, and then as I mentioned, rational use of these medications. We actually reduce medication use almost as often as we give access to medicine, because a lot of these people are, I would say, not using the medications in an efficient or rational way. So we need to be able to measure those savings, but I think this happens quite commonly. We're seeing increased buy-in from payers, I guess, is the other indicator that people are recognizing this, where they used to fight us to have people come see us. They're now actually encouraging patients to come see us in some cases because they recognize the value of this comprehensive type of approach. And then, I guess, lastly, we actually, just to toot our own horn for the second, we have the highest outpatient satisfaction scores in the entire university right now. So that's why the administration has changed their tune on us. And that doesn't mean that we're necessarily giving the very best care, but I think it does speak to the fact that these patients leave with being satisfied, and that continues to be the case as we follow them clinically. So we're proud of that. So thank you for your attention. I'm looking forward to hearing more today and speaking with some of you. Like I said, we're still in our infancy or toddler stage in terms of building this out, and I'm always open to suggestions or recommendations, because I think that's the best way that we're going to learn to do this the best way. So if you ever happen to be in San Diego, please come say hello. We're always happy to see our colleagues. Thanks very much.